By downloading or listening to this podcast, you are agreeing to Moody's legal terms and conditions found at moodys.com/disclaimer, including that the information provided is not investment or financial advice, and that Moody's will not be liable for losses arising from your use of the information.
I'm Danielle Reed, and this is Moody's Talks, Focus on Finance. In today's episode, from London, my co-host Carolyn Henson will be speaking with two Moody's banking team analysts. First, Eugene Tarzamanov in Singapore about the risks foreign currency fluctuations pose to emerging markets banks. And second, Arlene Sohn in Hong Kong about similar risks to financial institutions in Asia Pacific. Carolyn, hi. Welcome back to the show.
Hello, Danielle. Good to be here.
So, Carolyn, maybe you could give some background on your discussion with Eugene and Arlene. Why are we talking about foreign currency fluctuation risks to banks and financial institutions? And why is this a particular concern in emerging markets?
Well, Danielle, the bigger picture here is that over the past year, the dollar has strengthened a lot. That means that the value of local currencies in a lot of emerging markets has depreciated quite sharply against the dollar as well as against other major global currencies. The thing is that a lot of banks and other financial institutions in emerging markets have large dollar liabilities. For instance, banks use dollars for a lot of their lending, and they often also have large volumes of dollar deposits. So sharp depreciation of the local currency against the dollar can cause them problems. It can increase loan defaults, hurting profits, and it can also weaken their capital.
Right. Sounds like that can get pretty serious pretty quickly. And I'm guessing a main cause of the depreciation is the Federal Reserve's monetary policy response to rising inflation, which has been to raise the Fed funds rate all year.
That's right. And of course, there's been a similar central bank response to inflation in Europe, too.
Got it. And I gather from reading Eugene's and Arlene's reports that there are a lot of factors that determine whether or not banks and other financial institutions face high risk from foreign currency fluctuations.
Yeah, that's right. So you'll hear more about that when I sit down with Eugene and Arlene.
I'm looking forward to that discussion in just a few minutes. But first, it's time for Fast Finance. When Moody's analysts give their credit views on topics in the news. Joining me now in New York is Moody's analyst Steve Tu. Steve, welcome back to Focus on Finance.
Thanks, Danielle. Glad to be here.
So, Steve, in recent weeks, there have been statements from several different regulators in the US and Europe about the risks crypto assets could pose to the financial system. The most recent was a joint statement in the U.S. on January 3rd from the FDIC, the Fed Board of Governors, and the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, or OCC. First of all, what kind of risks are the regulators flagging?
Well, you know, with this statement, it was almost everything but the kitchen sink in there. And it's got everything ranging from fraud, misrepresentations, poor governance, risk management, you know, and then the typical, you know, volatility, contingent risk. And the regulators are really highlighting, you know, the risks of the banks from the assets themselves, as well as entities in the crypto sector to make sure that they don't migrate into the banking system.
Got it. And so how will all this regulatory attention affect banks and other financial institutions in that case?
Well, it's, you know, we view it as credit positive. And, you know, one of the key things we wanted to highlight was the tone of this statement. You know, it was very blunt. The language was, you know, quite strong. And, you know, this is from three regulators on a very timely topic. And it was all encapsulated in very clear language in two pages. And this stance to us seems like, you know, on the part of U.S. regulators was even stronger than what the Basel Committee laid out in its recommendations at the end of the year. And from a credit point of view, we view it as positive because it's going to make banks more cautious when dealing with, you know, this more volatile, riskier asset, lead to a stable, you know, more stable operating environment. And really, you know, in terms of like principal risk to banks, you know, in addition to volatility, you know, managing crypto assets also entails different risks that banks perhaps aren't as used to, And, you know, we, in addition to all the other risks, highlighted a couple of these types of operational risks, which include when you're dealing with a digital bearer or instrument, you know, custody risk takes on a whole new meaning because you could just walk out the door if you have photographic memory with a lot of value. And then also settlement risk, you know, banks are typically used to batch settlements at a much lower frequency than the quote unquote instantaneous settlement that, you know, a digital asset on a blockchain would encompass. What do they lose? You know, we didn't feel in our assessment of the banking industry revenues that there was going to be much loss. Currently crypto type fees, earnings accounts for a very limited portion, very small portion of banking revenues in aggregate. And the other, thing that we were thinking was that, you know, in recent years, just given the environment, you did see a lot of banks and other financial institutions really try to ramp up their capital expenditures in this area, you know, trying to get involved. And now with, you know, the more, you know, the harder investment climate, reduced pricing here. And now, especially with this, you know, hardened regulatory stance, we would feel that, you know, managers probably feel that the opportunity cost for them, you know, in not participating in the crypto sector more heavily is probably a lot lower. So all those, you know, those three are all very, you know, positive credit drivers for the banking system.
Yeah, I was going to say kind of the inside, if I had to summarize, it sounds like this is pretty strongly positive for banks and there's not much opportunity lost for them. I guess what you were saying is, less fear of missing out, if you could call it that. In the comment you published on this, you mentioned some broader implications of the regulatory scrutiny of crypto assets, in addition to the sort of more straightforward, you know, straight up positive implications for banks' credit. What are some of those broader implications?
Yeah, so we did want to elaborate our thinking a little bit just beyond the very, you know, more surface level credit positive. And, you know, the first point is that, you know, hey, in all this turmoil, you know, the core operations of some of the very, you know, more robust blockchains that are very open, they've continued to function as intended. And, you know, this technology, we don't think is, you know, it's on with given all the investment in there, the potential, you know, there's still potentially the possibility that this technology develops organically, maybe at a slower pace without so much interaction with the traditional financial system. And that could, you know, possibly be a healthier growth trajectory for the crypto universe.
And I think there was one more point, right, that you made?
Yeah. And the second one, you know, which is our closing statement really was kind of, you know, the US, EU, Bank of England and, you know, many other countries, they're still looking into digital currencies, right? Central bank digital currencies. So more of a state-led solution for trying to update money and payments. And the reason behind this is still that, you know, modern money that we know as electronic money, it's still a heterogeneous set of databases that looks nice on the surface, but it's fragmented and it's old technology. And, you know, there are inefficiencies there. It's a little bit costlier. And there is the potential, given our state of technology now, to update that. And there's also the element of the public money argument that, you know, we cite John Conliff. He's been a large proponent of that, or, you know, educator in that area. And, you know, really there, it's like, you know, the basic thinking is that, you know, as our lives become more digital, we don't have something that's like a backstop of a fundamental, you know, safe asset that we can use for financial transactions on the internet or in our digital lives. And we do have that in the real world. That's called cash, but we just don't have that form of public money in the digital world. And, you know, the case there is that, you know, well, you know, potentially we had a private sector solution for that, but it's looking more and more like the solutions that if money eventually evolves beyond the current state that we're used to now, especially in the US, that it's more likely to take a state-driven form, you know, like a CBDC that would work either alongside or, you know, integrated with the banking system that we know currently.
Right. I guess given all the turmoil that there's been in the crypto markets, maybe has made that even more likely that it'll go that path. Really interesting, Steve. Thanks very much. And we're now joined by Sadia Nabi, who's here to talk about recent developments at Silvergate Bank. Sadia, thanks for coming back to the show.
Hi, Danielle. Thank you so much for having me. It's always good to talk to you.
Sadia, Steve just mentioned that most bank earnings won't be affected by increased regulatory attention to crypto asset risk because, well, most banks don't derive a lot of revenue from crypto assets. But there are some exceptions, and I think Silvergate is one of them because it's a bank that is mainly focused on the digital currency industry. In fact, Moody's recently downgraded the ratings of Silvergate Bank. So what was behind the ratings downgrades?
So there was a confluence of factors that impacted Silvergate, which led to the downgrade. One was that they are a very highly concentrated bank, and their main line of business is servicing the crypto-centric industry or the cryptocurrency industry and fintechs. So once, you know, it wasn't just FTX that collapsed several months before FTX Cerberus had collapsed as well. So there was already a lot of chaos. Now, as a monoline bank or a bank that is only focused in this industry, any chaos that's happening in the market will directly impact them significantly. And we saw that a lot of, following FTX, as a lot of deposits flowed out of Silvergate, Silvergate was forced to meet those deposit needs and had to sell their available for sale securities. And as they disclosed, because of the interest rate environment, even though they had liquidity, they had to take a significant loss to be able to sell those securities and meet those deposit outflow needs. The other aspect of this is, you know, if we look forward, if this bank's main business is SEN Leverage and the SEN Network, which is primarily servicing the fintech industry and the crypto-centric industry, what happens when this business is no longer viable? Will these deposits come back? Will this industry get revived? Is there going to be more chaos? So it changes the forward trajectory of this bank significantly. The other aspect of this that we've always identified is that regulatory risk is very high for Silvergate. And that's not just related to the chaos that the cryptocurrency industry went through recently, but this has been an aspect that we've always identified, a very high risk industry. Regulatory risk is very high. So there was a confluence of factors that eventually led to the downgrade.
Okay, so it sounds like it wasn't any one thing is what you're, you know, trying to get across here. And I now have a better appreciation of that. And you say regulatory factors are a real risk here. So are you including, you know, the recent regulatory statements about crypto asset risks that Steve was talking about just now?
You know, that's a really good question. And there's two aspects to answer it. First of all, I'd like to go back to what Steve mentioned, right? When there, as new regulation comes, that is very, very credit positive for the banks because it does provide clarity. It does provide the rules of the road, for example, of how to operate, how to evaluate risk. And stepping back, even though cryptocurrency industry has been around for several years now, regulation is still playing catch up, right? Regulatory, there's always a lag between regulation and the industry. So as more regulation comes, it will be easier for banks to navigate this space. But on the other hand, regulation could discourage newer bank entrants as well. Because is this business viable? Is there too much of a regulatory burden? So there's this space, the regulatory aspect is still developing. We are monitoring very closely and how it will change the dynamic of how banks operate in this space. Yes.
Saadia and Steve, thank you both very much for your insights. And I'm now joined by Carolyn Henson, who will be speaking with Moody's banking team analysts, Eugene Tarzimanov in Singapore, and Arlene Sohn in Hong Kong about the risks foreign currency fluctuations pose to emerging markets, banks, and financial institutions in Asia Pacific.
Thanks, Danielle. Eugene and Arlene, welcome.
Glad to be here.
Hi, Caroline. Thanks for having me.
Eugene, let's start with you. Since your report covers emerging markets worldwide, and you looked at a broad set of emerging market banks to determine which ones have the highest exposure to foreign currency fluctuations, right?
Yes, we have looked at around 40 emerging markets globally where foreign currency deposits are 10% or more of total deposits. So we kind of zoomed onto those systems where there is some level of dollarization. So the goal was to rank order those banking systems by the relative level of foreign currency risk. So how did we do that? So we used two broad criteria. So the first one includes structural factors such as dollarization levels, local regulations, and types of effects regimes in a country. So the second set of factors includes cyclical components that may amplify or decrease risk for banks. And here, we have looked at current accounts and overall foreign currency debt levels. So by combining the structural and cyclical factors, we were able to identify the banking systems that are more exposed to foreign currency risk.
I see. And can you explain briefly what the danger is to a borrower that has, say, a dollar-denominated loan but is earning revenue in a local currency?
Well, if you're a company or an individual and you borrow in dollars, and you have to make a loan repayments in dollars, right? But if your revenues or income is in local currency, then if your local currency greatly depreciates against the dollar, then all of a sudden, your loan repayments are much higher. So this increases the risk of default.
Right. And I suppose then that becomes a problem for the banks if you multiply that issue by a large number of borrowers, right?
Well, yes, exactly. So the banks become vulnerable to an increase in defaults on those foreign currency loans, particularly if those loans are granted to borrowers without hedges. And this can hurt your bank's loan quality and profitability. And also liquidity and capital can come under pressure.
So there are other problems for banks as well, right?
Yes. So the potential issues are not only limited to higher problem loans. There's a few other potential issues at play. So one is related to deposits. So if your local currency materially drops, then those local deposits might be swapped into dollars. Or, which is more dangerous, they might actually leave the bank altogether. This is something we call the deposit run. So this can create issues for the liquidity of your bank. So the other issues are related to capital erosion from foreign currency revaluation and the increase in risk-weighted assets. So your bank's capital ratio can go down.
Got it. So which countries did you find had the highest exposure to this kind of foreign currency risk?
Yes, against those, among the 40 markets that we looked at, those with the highest risks are Turkey, Nigeria, Ukraine, Belarus, El Salvador, Tajikistan, and Kyrgyz Republic.
And what about the other end of the spectrum, the banks in countries that have the least exposure to foreign currency fluctuations?
The least exposed would be banks in Chile, Cote d'Ivoire, Guatemala, Indonesia, the Philippines, and finally, Vietnam.
Okay, so that moves us nicely over to Arlene, actually, because Arlene's report focuses on financial institutions in the Asia-Pacific region and their exposures to foreign currency risk. So Arlene, many local currencies in Asia-Pacific have also depreciated significantly against the dollar from a year ago. Is it the same kind of foreign currency risk we've been talking about across the region there?
Well, broadly speaking, the risk was not very high in the region because most of the 395 financial institutions that we looked at in Asia-Pacific in 17 economies did not have a high level of net foreign currency liabilities, which means the size of foreign currency liabilities that exceeds the size of foreign currency assets. For institutions that had large net foreign currency liabilities, they usually had mitigating factors that lowered the risk.
Okay, but you found some exceptions, right?
Yeah, correct. Mainly non-bank financial institutions and mainly finance companies had higher refinancing, repayment, or capital loss risk from the local currency depreciation because they had high foreign currency exposures even after you factor in swaps in place as a hedge, and they didn't have other mitigants in place to protect them from repayment risk or capital erosion.
And what share of all the financial institutions that you looked at were in that higher risk category?
It was a small percentage of the total set of financial institutions we looked at. In the study, we looked for institutions with net foreign currency liabilities that were larger than 20% of their total common equity, because we considered that level to be large. The net foreign currency liabilities we looked at reflected currency swap arrangements where the data was available. And it was around 7% of the financial institutions that we rate in Asia Pacific that had net foreign currency liabilities of 20% or more. But of those, only a small percentage were at high risk from foreign currency fluctuations, because most of these institutions had mitigants against the risks, such as swaps in place, but not publicly disclosed, so not reflected in our data analysis. Benefits from natural hedging through foreign currency non-financial assets, or a status as a government-related institution that underpinned its access to foreign currency funding.
Arlene, I have just one question for you. You also mentioned that even some financial institutions with net foreign currency assets or very small net currency liabilities, and you know, both of those, you'd think those situations would be favorable when local currencies are depreciating against the dollar. But that even in those situations, some financial institutions aren't immune from risks from foreign currency fluctuations. So how does that work?
Well, it's because institutions can still have maturity mismatches between liabilities and assets if they use short-term foreign currency funds to invest in illiquid foreign currency assets. These risks can be high for institutions in emerging markets in Asia Pacific, given that two-thirds of them had foreign currency debt maturity within the next 6 to 12 months, although we expect these risks to be limited if an institution has access to development funds, which tend to be cheaper and more stable. Also, banks may have foreign currency liabilities off their balance sheets, such as letters of credit for importers, which will require banks to incur additional foreign currency outflows to honor the commitments.
Arlene, Carolyn, and Eugene, thank you for your insights. And thank you also to Steve and Sadia. And thank you very much to our listeners for tuning in. If you'd like to explore this topic further, you can do that by following the links in the show notes for this episode at moodys.com/podcasts. And please tune in again soon for future episodes of Focus on Finance.
Thanks for listening to this Moody's Talks podcast. To find out more about the topics discussed, please follow the links in the show notes. You can check out other Moody's Talks podcasts by visiting moodys.com/podcasts.